Hello, and welcome to another episode of the Radical Thoughts Podcast. In this bonus episode, I bring on our first repeat guest, C. Derek Varn, to discuss Jean Baudrillard, following our season one ending read of The System of Objects. This is our last bonus episode before we start season two, which should hopefully happen in just a couple weeks, when we'll be discussing Raymond Williams' The Politics of Modernism. Right now, you're listening to 22 Ghosts 3 by Nine Inch Nails, but in a second, you'll hear us discuss the history of Baudrillard's thought, his relationship with the Situationists, and whether or not he provides any practical way out of the modern condition.
So I think this is the first time we've had a repeating guest on the show, because you came on to talk about Adorno before. Mm-hmm. So I'm just having you on again, because who else can talk about black-pilled, depressed philosophers better? But also, you've appeared on a couple other things talking about Baudrillard. And on the one hand, he has a lot of stuff that gets into very kind of obnoxious post-structuralist territory, post-modernist territory. But at the same time, you've noted when you situate him in the context of what's going on with the left, with his prior political commitments up to that point, he's a lot more insightful in his commentary about what's going on socially. And this is literally the first thing, if I'm correct, that he got published as a full manuscript since it's his dissertation. And
yep.
That actually got published. And when we did our episode on it, none of us were really quite sure. We weren't really sure how it related or was different from or had any connection to or prefigures his later work, particularly his falling away from Marxist political economy in his kind of middle period, and then his much more famous, you know, kind of simulacra semiotics period way later on.
Yeah, what I would say is there's a continuity here, in that you can tell his concerns are largely coming out of both, you know, Marxist cultural critique as it stood in France, as opposed to what we know in the German American tradition and like the Frankfurt School or Gramsci. So it's coming out of like Lefebvre and Bataille. He's also considered pretty at this period, almost directly adjacent to like the academic form of the Situationists, because he holds to a lot of their basic critiques. And if you like, so for example, he thinks with the Situationists that consumption has become primary overproduction, which is also something shared by Debord and Vanim and a lot of the Situationists. He also picks up from structuralist semiotics that all the signs in an object represent something to their user. And so when you read like the first chapters of The System of Objects, there's a lot of stuff about like the meaning of what of the kind of interpretive meaning of functionalism triumphing over all this like earlier bourgeois furniture, and materiality, and what it would say about the materiality. Although what I find interesting is he just assumes you would agree with his interpretation of bourgeois meaning of objects. He just kind of asserts it outright, and it's not questioned. There's also, you know, he's still a pretty dedicated communist, although in this time period, he would have been considered sort of you know, part of the left opposition, or the like, you know, almost left communist adjacent. Like I said, he's pretty directly tied to the Situationist. And I think he's, in this book in particular, trying to work out some of the implications of their thought on Marxist aesthetics and semiotics. And, you know, his PhD committee, as we talked about off air, is pretty, it's Henri Lefebvre, it's Pierre Bourdieu, and it's Roland Barthes. So you can't get like a more, you know, core of Marxist through post-Marxist sort of cultural critics there. But he gets frustrated with Marxism pretty quickly. Right. And this is right before that happens. So you already see the, like him accepting the situationist distinction from Marx. He goes much further a few years later in 1974 when he does the Mirror production, which basically is aimed at Marxist nodes of production in general. And you will also notice that he's not, even in this time period of the System Objects, he uses value in a way that I think reappropriates it in several different spheres. Has almost nothing to do with the way value is used in Das Kapital, which was a tendency for French thinkers to do, to just kind of run with the word. But, you know, so in this, there's functional value, which is instrumental or use value, exchange value or abstract value, symbolic value, which is the relational value between the giver and the receiver, which this comes from Saussure, and it's basically structural, and then the sign value within the system of objects. You know, so what is actually, you know, what is being represented by the particular object, its material construction, and what it might mean to you in the specific instance. So that's very important to this work. Although he doesn't systematically bring that out in the beginning. It's not written in an analytic way where that's stated clearly and forthright. You have to kind of work through the book to get it. But you can already tell he's kind of moving away from, you know, like a lot of the people who focus on consumption, like actually the late Frankfurt School too, that they're very much reacting to consumer society. They think the consumer has basically replaced the worker.
Right.
But he gets pretty frustrated with the French Communist Party, you know, almost immediately. So, you know, and if you also look at his inspirations like Bataille, I mean, Bataille is arguably a Marxist, kind of sometimes. But you can see that like anthropological focus on exchange, potlatch and all that actually really influencing Baudrillard in a way that doesn't usually come up in standard theoretical Marxism. But it's kind of to me important that Baudrillard's reacting to a crisis in the French Communist Party that happens after 68 happens. Mm-hmm. You know, so this comes out kind of concurrent to 68, and then basically the entire rest of his career is him responding to and becoming more and more disillusioned with the left, because he sees it as having a narrative drive that leads to basically, you know, abstractifications and delusions. And while this is implicit in his, you know, 80s work, which I think is what people are more familiar with, like Semerloch and Simulation, it's kind of explicit in two texts that were written around the same period that are much more about the left, you know, itself, which is The Divine Left and In the Shadow of Silent Majorities, both of which are probably in red. What I find interesting also about like what you can find by Baudrillard, for example, there's sort of a weird publishing spread on these. So a lot of the earlier stuff, and then weirdly, the very late stuff is published by Verso, and particularly in the Radical Thinkers theory. So you got a lot of stuff from the 60s and the early 70s, and a lot of stuff from like the 90s and the right before he died in the aughts. Weirdly, Semiotex at Michigan, University of Michigan Press, had mostly published this stuff that is actually more about his direct engagement with the left itself, which means that like academics know it if they specialize in post-structuralism, but a lot of leftists haven't read it at all.
Right.
So he gets, he basically becomes blackpilled by both the Marxist overclaim of a theoretical apparatus that can explain history, which he thinks doesn't actually hold. And it's definitely true by 1974. But he also thinks that they also don't really want the politics they say they want. Like the creation of the social world he sees is not really what they actually do. That for all their talk of violent revolutions, they obscure that, you know, they actually mostly function as like a loyal opposition to the Socialist Party and empower it. And they don't ever really try to take power in any extra political, extra electoral means. And so the rhetoric seems mostly for Baudrillard not about you know, what they actually want to do, but about maintaining a simulation and a narrative of a radical break, which doesn't ever happen and which they have no intent on delivering.
Right.
So this work is, you know, the system, the object is when he's still trying to reconcile, you know, structural semiotics with Marxism. And he wasn't the only person trying to do it. The issue is it doesn't really work. Like,
right. Yeah.
It's, you know, Althusser tries to functionally do the same thing, actually. And
I mean, early Barthes is also a Marxist, even when he's doing like some of his early mythologies, semiotics too. And he just kind of goes, oh, I'm not really a Marxist anymore. And then just keeps being a semiotician. It's interesting that you talked about him in relation to the situationists too, because we noted that at the end of the book, you know, I think it does come out 67, if I remember correctly. So it's right before 68. We weren't sure if at this point he actually had any direct connection to the situationists and their milieu or texts. We didn't really have a good timeline for that or any clear indication of it. But we were noting that it seems similar in some of its points. But like even in this book where he's trying to reconcile it, we thought it was kind of interesting how when he gets to his conclusion, he never really chooses to go, and this is why we need to establish the general council. This is why we need to take over or something. He kind of has this already prefigured, we have to be cautious that talk of revolution doesn't also just fit into the system of objects. The end.
He kind of, in a way, I mean, we would talk about it in the American left is the anti-capitalist critique of capitalism is already writ in capitalism. And Baudrillard, he takes that seriously before a lot of other leftists in France do. He doesn't phrase it in that way, although he sees the system of objects as a almost progressive and natural development from early bourgeois culture. But he also sees this as like, this isn't going to be a clean way out. For Baudrillard, you get the feeling that by the middle of the 70s, he thinks any positing of a clean way out is delusional. I sometimes joke that one of the issues with Baudrillard is he's both more radical and more reactionary than almost any critic of Marxism, and that he's like trying to push this to its logical conclusion, particularly these trends coming out of France. But he's also kind of more willing to talk about the implications without like falling into, frankly, what I think Althusser does, which is obscuring through jargon mongering, where you can't quite tell if Althusser means much, you know, the way he used idealist and ideology and this, that, and the other. Most people don't really know what he means. Baudrillard, for all his supposed difficulty, is actually usually pretty easy to read.
It's partially because he's so polemical. Like, he's very good at just being like, here's what I think of this and why I'm dissatisfied with it. Like, even this book, we were noting, it follows a very strange, I mean, I know that you said that it reads very different from his later work, but it has a very strange, almost like, here's a couple observations about something, and he draws out what this relates to his semi-systemic, like, thing that he kind of implies, but he never really, like, lays out how he's analyzing anything. Mm-hmm. He just kind of just says, like, we can note that the cars are doing this, and like he just kind of like asserts stuff, but he's not really doing an analytical piece with a clear like systemic approach to his categories, or if it, like there's a kind of a system there, but he's not trying to lay out what he's doing. He just does it.
Yeah. So I think that's, you know, I think it's interesting because I also think that's something that we find frustrating in our tradition of rhetoric. But if you read post-structuralism in general, they all do that. So you are bringing up his relationships to the situationists. This book comes out the same year as Society as Spectacle, but he was actually in dialogue with Debord. And in fact, he was part of that theorization of this idea of the consumer spectacle, which kind of goes back. You know, you see a similar trait in the Frankfurt School, and the function, you know, the function of the cultural industry and society. He's interested in that, but he sees this as almost not just a sociological problem, not a problem of production like the Frankfurt School kind of does. He also sees it as part of an epistemic drive to have certainty where there can be none. And he doesn't fully state that until the mid-70s, where he really breaks with the Marxists formally. Mm-hmm. And, you know, when we mentioned his dissertation committee again, two of those people also break with Marxism. I mean, Bourdieu breaks with Marxism, but it's not a hard break, but he does.
Yeah, I mean, he Bourdieu is kind of interesting because I feel like he never... I don't know if there's any period where he really tries to claim he's a Marxist either. He just mm-hmm. would say, oh, I was in a position where, like, in French culture, that was just a thing that was very, like, inspiring, but I was never really that.
Right.
And then you have Barthes, and then you have Lefebvre, who's kind of his own weird, always the kind of, like, I'm the heterodox Marxist who
right.
is trying to be different and modernize it into, like, a new... context kind of thing.
Right. And he maintains that. I mean, and so it isn't totally surprising that also when your obsessions are like Bataille, that you would go to this weird cultural influence Marxism. I think a lot of people read this as bad Marxism on the case of a Baudrillard, but the issue with that is it's these assumptions are kind of across the board in Marxist academia outside of the formal Communist Party of France. And the Communist Party of France is all in its Krugevian bourgeois pop front mode, which it's in from Gaullism all the mm-hmm. way through till basically the Mitterrand government. Yeah. That's the context for Baudrillard. And I mean, particularly when you read The Divine Left and The Shadow of Silent Majorities, he's really angry with them for not being radical enough. I mean, like, yeah. he's like furious with them, but also he even though he comes out of this analysis of the spectacle, which, you know, leads directly into Simulation and Simulacra, it comes out of A System of Objects. He really also breaks with the situationist in that he doesn't think that this tendency is just like a weird bourgeois enforced cultural deviation that's just there to distract you. He seems to think this is innate mm-hmm. in the way people try to construct absolute knowledge, and that this is a broader problem. This is a broader problem in the absence of high modernist narratives and old religious notions than just, you know, a problem of Marxism.
Andrew, my co-host Andrew, who I think he's the only one Donald has probably read a little bit other Baudrillard, but I think Andrew's probably read more. He was saying how, like, later Baudrillard reaches the point where he talks about the entirety of the world is like, a machine expelling like the human from mm-hmm. it. And the thing is that he sounds almost like he could be either a primitivist or like a Nicolandian kind of like accelerationist, except that he doesn't accept like that there is ever a break in it. Like, he doesn't have the Nicolandian like, and then this will like accelerate into this like whole new level of something. It's just, it accelerates into towards being what it already is kind of how I would put it. Like, it just becomes more of itself, and it never has this like full, like, there's no other, like, thing beyond it, almost.
Right. I mean, so the hyper-reality isn't... You're not going to have hyper-reality turn into hard reality in a way that, like, brings about the new tentacle-faced subject of the universe or whatever, to make, you know, to mock Nick Land a bit. What happens with Baudrillard is he basically thinks everything's just going to intensify into increasing levels of simulation. Mm-hmm. And that simulation is relied upon as a proxy for incomplete knowledge. And so you can definitely see why he's associated with the postmodernist, leotard more than say, like, I don't know, Foucault and his epistemes mm-hmm. or whatever, because for Baudrillard, this is not just like a bracketed historical period with its bracketed historical episteme. This is a larger general tendency.
And you can see why he becomes this figure of like this post-internet age. We did feel like on an intuitive level actually was made sense, is that he says the intensification of the black box problem, right? Like the everything gets connected in a way that complexifies to a level that it has to run without you understanding why or how. And everyone becomes reliant on everything running the way it does, but no one can actually do anything to intervene in it, understand it. So you just have to pretend that you know what's going on because you need the machine to be working. And if the machine breaks down, hypothetically, no one's going to be able to do anything about it, which right. I think it is like something that Marxists, when they talk about, you know, the advancement of productive forces or something, tend to ignore.
You can think about Taner's Collapse of Complex Societies. You can think about the kind of reactionary existentialist response to Marx and Heidegger and whatnot, that they had misunderstood humans' capacity for reason, that they had bought into an Enlightenment myth about reason itself as ever being that clarified. I mean, one of the things that is clear in this book and has become more and more clear as the further Baudrillard develops his break with Marxism is that he thinks that use value is an incoherent concept because uses are not innate. That there's always some kind of cultural prescription going on there that instantiates the use. This is actually, you know, structurally kind of interestingly similar to Althusser, who does this with ideology. Like it's a very similar sort of framework. I actually find Baudrillard's explanation for it to be more cogent in a lot of ways than like, oh, it's ideology written back upon yourself, always interpolating everything. And, you know, Baudrillard's like, well, this is not just a social drive. This is a personal drive. And it's also a flaw in the Enlightenment conception of which Marx inherited about what reason and, you know, reasonable use would ever be, that you could have sort of a clear use emergent from a thing in a way that has no prescription, that just kind of is automatic. And that's part of his point, even this early in the system of objects. So when I talk about how different it is different. And then he's still trying to state this in a way that you could be kind of a heterodox Marxist of the 1950s and 60s and be somewhat copacetic in an academic circle, at least, even if you couldn't be in the formal communist parties. But by the mid-1970s, this just explodes out where he's even attacking the situationists for their spectacle being theorized and assuming too much and assuming too many, you know, innate uses and functions. And what's interesting to him is he also picks up on Marcel Mauss and, again, Bataille on how much symbolic exchange and cultural exchange and these seemingly irrational gift cultures actually seem to work, and that Marxism just doesn't really deal with it, even though these people, you know, all the people he lists, or at least in the case of Bataille, they all think they're being Marxist. I mean, even Luxembourg, Rosa Luxemburg talks about gift cultures to some degree.
Right.
But Bataille's just like, Baudrillard's just like, it's not actually in line with Marxist logic as even understood by Marx. Mm-hmm.
If I remember his main essay on Bataille, on the Accursed Share, it's interesting because Bataille basically tries to rewrite historical materialism from the perspective of consumption. Mm-hmm. That's kind of his late project after he's being like less purely weird and surrealist. Mm-hmm. And he's still speculative and weird, but he's also like, he actually stumbles onto like some real anthropological like things and actually is maybe kind of insightful in certain problems of the USSR and stuff. But he still kind of holds this idea that, well, you can advance consumption and develop consumption and like socially mediate it, like understand the social mediation of it in a way that produces communism or what have you. And Baudrillard kind of critiques him from the perspective of, he's like, oh, well, Bataille still thinks that you can like achieve, you know, the endless sun anus god that just showers you with consumptive ability, but he doesn't realize that his own concept of consumption is actually what breaks off that possibility. Like right. he Baudrillard kind of says like, Bataille is right about the like drive and social development of consumption, but he argues that that's what continually closes off the possibility of even like understanding or developing society in any way.
Yeah, I mean, well, he basically thinks the social starts to decline and you know, kind of totality. What's interesting is if you take Simulacra and read it on top of something like Marx's notions of reification, because like if you look at in Simulation of Simulacra, what he says that epochal simulacra is, so during early bourgeois production, it is the product. But he actually says by the 1950s, the simulacra is the model, which is infinitely reproducible and not bound by the same kind of constraints as material reproducibility of the early bourgeois period. And I mean, if you're in the Marshall McLuhan or you study the internet or even study like the importance of coding and monopoly rents on the economy, that like Bataille seems to be kind of onto something in a way. I don't really agree with how he views it. But he also says that this infinite reproducibility leads to a crisis of historiography. So, like, there is no possibility of progress because everything is infinitely modable, infinitely reproducible. So the idea of progress itself is undermined by this progress. And instead of it being the culmination of this in this kind of Hegelian Francis Fukuyama way, it's actually like historicity stops having any meaning.
Well, he almost explicitly says that he believes that, like, the idea of contradiction no longer holds, that like there's no such thing as an innate contradiction within something. The idea of the model object and the serial object, because everything's only in relation to everything else, it has no, there's nothing inherent within it to hold a contradiction, or for a social contradiction to exist.
And you think something like his statement from the essay, The Violence of the Global, where he says, you know, in the Enlightenment, universalization was viewed as the unlimited growth and forward progress. Today, by contrast, universalization is expressed as a forward escape, you know, escaping out of history itself or escaping out of progressive development through this infinite reproducibility, through simulated games, through, I mean, you know, whatever. I mean, he... So, you know, I think what's interesting about Baudrillard and both the theory of systems, and where, I mean, theory of objects and where he takes it, or the system of objects, excuse me, and where he takes it is that a lot of these ideas are kind of implicit, but under theorized in situationism. And he kind of takes them to their logical conclusion, which ends up undoing, you know, and Baudrillard's are the entire Marxist project, like altogether. What I think is interesting, though, is that's his theoretical justifications for it. But if you actually read the two books that I mentioned, he talks about like what he sees happening in French society that is driving this, and the way that these political parties actually act for him seemed to me like they don't want to win. They don't want to win because it would actually remove their ability to simulate the struggle over and over again. That they want to simulate power, but not actually have power, deal with the violence of power. They don't want to be the men with the guns. They want to be the people who have the jouissance, almost, you know, use the Kantian phrase work of almost always being the people, you know, with the gun. I mean, he basically says they want to lose because they're stuck in this, you know, there is no way for them to win anyway, but they don't even really want to. And that's driving a lot of his theories around this time. I mean, but what one thing I can say about all of these post-structuralists in France and in Italy, they start doubling down on their categories to, you know, on almost absurd degree by the time you get to the late 90s. So
on the one hand, it's easy to kind of get annoyed at Baudrillard or dismiss him for being sort of a like philosophical shit poster with like some of the stuff that he writes. But there is, I mean, today, like now there's basically no like real Communist Party. Sorry if you're a dangist. You know, it's hard not to like feel like he's onto something when you look at the like LARPing about even the people that want to have the guns don't actually want to have the guns. They just want to be a single person who gets to have a glorious last stand and post on Twitter about like how they have guns.
It's the beautiful loser syndrome on crack.
Or on the other hand, you know, you just get people who are just saying, like, well, we just need to have a party. We just need to organize like the great revolutionary party. And we just need this one neat trick that the bourgeoisie hates kind of thing that is obviously not tied to like any sort of capacity. The entire relationship of it is just the slogan in and of it for itself, because it makes you feel good to say it, like not even good to think that something will happen from it. So there is something about him that feels relevant in that sense, though. I think it's odd, though, because I feel like Baudrillard's boom as a thinker was probably more in the 2000s into the late 2000s. He's a person that now, if you hear about him, you probably hear about him. You hear about the simulacrum, like you'd be like, this guy inspired the Matrix, but you won't. I don't see a lot of people that are like, I'm a Baudrillard scholar. I really like talk about Baudrillard's theory.
No, I mean, that's one of the reasons why I somewhat defend him is because of that group of post-structuralist thinkers, he's the one that I find actually interesting. Whereas I mean, not to say Foucault is not interesting. There are things by Foucault worth defending, but like the theory of the episteme or whatever is almost just like, it's almost a non-theory. The bracketing out of transitions between historical epochs, it's, you know, it becomes a circular theory of culture and cultural understanding. Like, why is something believed? Because it's believed at this time. And that's not what Baudrillard is doing at all. Furthermore, it's not as flippant as, you know, Lyotard and a lot of the other post-Marxist, post-modernist or post-structuralist. Nor is Baudrillard like his American contemporaries like Rorty Fish, like Stanley Fish, you know, who come out of this deconstruction are J. Hollis Miller or any of those guys. He's not a liberal. Like he sees that as another fundamental delusion. Whereas those other people use, you know, a lot of these same contexts to actually maintain a kind of genteel left liberalism. Mm-hmm. You know, Baudrillard basically also thinks that's just another lie.
He doesn't really believe in like the, well, there's all these like different narratives that can't be reconciled, but you can create some sort of like public sphere that reveals new dialogues and overturns established canons or something. Like, he's not really interested in that.
No, I mean, he basically in some ways follows the black pill to an ultimate conclusion that he would see as most of the rest of society is wanting to avoid, including his contemporaries. And I find that interesting, even if I'm a bit repelled by it. Okay, let's follow this logic out to where it actually goes. If you really don't believe in meta narratives, if you really believe that most of this is a kind of shell game to make you feel better about about the lack of meaning in the world, if you really think a lot of these systems of meanings and object relations are literally a way of replacing a lack of a cohesive narrative and any epistemological certainty, then why would you believe in any of it? And Baudrillard basically says, well, you shouldn't. And, you know, even if there was a Gulf War, it didn't take place because all you know is the simulacrum and representation of it and the various meta narratives around it. You don't actually know and cannot experience the Gulf War itself. And he hinted at it with 9/11 and then backed the hell off. And also he was old and dying by that point. But, you know, he's also interesting as one of these French academics whose most productive period is actually in his 60s. You know, his dissertation was not written young. I mean, he was born in 1929. I think that also needs to be placed into this conception, as he saw like kind of he lived through a lot of the second half of the arc of French Marxism, of the Gaullism, of, you know, he would have heard stories and maybe have vague memories about the resistance. Mm-hmm. These were not completely outside of his purview. And yeah, he also outlives a lot of his contemporaries. He's one of these figures, you know, unlike a lot of the situationists, who doesn't off himself. So, I mean, there's a lot of that going on. What I think is interesting from the context of trying to understand Baudrillard's I've always taken him as what, you know, I used to joke that like I'm on Team Germany, not Team France. And Baudrillard's kind of like the ultimate culmination as to why. Because I think Baudrillard actually takes seriously like the Sartrean critique of dialectics is back there. Bataille's, you know, flirtation with Potlatch. The situation is focused on the consumer and the spectacle and the and consumption as a distorting factor. He's also marrying a lot of conservative critics of Marxism and pointing out, well, the workers don't identify as workers. The collective worker pretty much fell apart in the 1950s almost everywhere. And, you know, he seems to think that, like, Marxism's in denial about its own crisis. I mean, he says so explicitly a lot in the late 70s. Like I said, the divine left is all about nothing but that.
Right.
And, you know, and what's weird about that, I mean, if Baudrillard's easy to quote because he's kind of a shit-posting philosopher, but how relevant this often feels to people, like if you read his essay from The Divine Left, the Ecstasy of Socialism, and like apply it to the Bernie Sanders moment, it can make people feel like it's super relevant, just like it felt like it was directly aimed at the Communist Party dealing with Mitterrand. You know, that's a lot of what's going on there.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that kind of leads to like the question, how do you acknowledge what Baudrillard is doing and how he is actually going further than almost any of his other contemporaries in trying to address what was the conditions and like the political incentives and political ideals of the time, but also try to recognize what he is maybe overstating or misrepresenting. I mean, the obvious one is, of course, like people are just like, oh, this guy clearly doesn't understand capital, or like his understanding of the theory of value is not what Marx means by value or something like that. But as you point out, that's like also he's kind of like swimming in the water there, like that it's not.
I mean, that's universal, even on Team Germany by that point. Almost everybody thinks that the productivist understanding was either wrong, or if it wasn't wrong, it's somehow hampered in such a way by new developments in capital that bracket it out. And I mean, it's one of the crises of the left in France is responding to, like, you know, not only did the French Communist Party get blindsided by 68, they also just don't have a lot to say that isn't, you know, basically pop frontism, developmentalism in general. You know, for Baudrillard, it's like, yeah, but it's because you never did and never could. Like, this is not just a betrayal. It's literally like the logic never holds in the first place. What I think is interesting about this, though, is for Baudrillard, you do have this bracketing out of the ability, like the inability to have epistemic certainty is kind of almost confused with the ability to construct a viable narrative at all. And that to me is a kind of an conservative turn. Like, I always talk about this in the terms of like the Puranic skeptics, who, if you really believe that the history is ended and you really believe you can't know anything, when there's no reason to buck social convention ever. Ironically, you know, as radical of analysis as it seems, like, oh, well, all, you know, social convention's fake, but then you say, well, yeah, but your counter knowledge of that is equally fake, so you might as well just go with the flow. And, you know, I know Shallon Van Tine gets mad at me when I say this, but this is to me like the reactionary implications of a lot of Baudrillardian thought. Because, well, you know, if all of it's simulacra and there's no way out of the simulacra, you know, other than like maybe The Agony of Power, his last essay in 2005, where he critiques the idea of power relations itself. Which that almost sounds like, you know, that sounds like a mystical anarchism or something. I mean, like, you know, to most people anyway. And are a philosophical anarchist position where you're saying like power is always with us, yet it's bad. You know, inherently. And I, you know, I what I think is interesting is like, a lot of my response to Baudrillard is like, is more the so what factor. Like, if you're correct, then you've told us effectively we can't live without delusions anyway. Mm-hmm. So why would anyone have the incentive to embrace your black pill when you've said that they really can't?
Why should I care that you choose to live in this simulacra by being an old man ranting at a cloud? when that's all that it would ultimately boil down to anyway.
Exactly. Like,
it's just another element of it. Yeah, it does kind of, I think, get to the heart of that sort of extreme, the social constructivist critique that then itself turns into a critique of social constructivism via social constructivism. Because it's, again, like, because we've talked about him before and he's one of the supervisors, like the thing that I think differentiates someone like Boisdu, who is also very well known for being a, like, social constructivist par excellence, is like, to him, he's like, oh, there's totally like real objective truths in things, like there's stuff beyond us. And but for him, it's like, just because everything is socially mediated doesn't mean that you can't, like, the social mediation is in relation to something. It's pointing at something. And even if you can't really ever, like, fully grasp it, like, you can feel it out and, like, move around it through the differentiations of experience and conflicts through it. So it kind of, he has like a subtle kind of like Hegelianism to it, that there's like, oh, there's like contradictions in the way that everyone is like interacting with this thing that like produces more and more kind of understandings of it. And Baudrillard is just like, no, yeah, well, like there's no distinction between the real and the unreal, right? Like, that's the whole point of the simulacrum. It's like it dissolves the barrier between like your non-knowledge and what is supposedly beyond it.
In some ways, it actually makes Baudrillard's position almost paradoxical himself. Like, how can he expose what's beyond the simulacra by insisting on the simulacra? Because, I mean, in a way, it's like, okay, so how do I know that you're not also, if I take your theory, just positing another simulacra to which I can relate to, thinking I can get beyond this, but not, even though you're telling me I can't, but it itself seems like, you see how this can twist your head in knots if you try to take it on its face at all. But I mean, it's one of the reasons why I respect Baudrillard and actually have, I mean, and you're right, like, Baudrillard's height, I think, really came for me when I was in grad school in like 2005. He was part of that series on responses to 9/11 and the Gulf War. He was published with Zizek, but he also was like the when everybody was getting tired of all their professors like wanking on about Foucault, that you just go and find, you know, Baudrillard Foucault and like throw it at their face in class, like oh, yeah, well, the death of the author hasn't killed Foucault yet, like. But it is interesting how historical and instantiated it is. It's also interesting that, to me, a lot of his more important texts have been translated recently when he's not as popular. Yeah. So like The Divine Left is like 2 years old in English. It's, you know, originally notes from the 70s, but, there's been a lot of his milieu published in English, in the last 5 or 6 years, which is interesting because, like you say, he's actually not a figure who is widely referenced as much anymore, although I think everybody from a certain age will have Simulacra and Simulations in their library, because we were all made to read it, just like everybody of a certain age will have, like, Of Grammatology by Derrida and, you know, right, somewhere in there, and, you know, The History of Sexuality, Volume 1, 2, and 3. The crap translations or whatever, in their purview, you know. I also think the Marxist resurgence, as well as the anarchist resurgence of the late 90s, has sort of actually left people like Baudrillard to be appropriated by liberals who use it in, like, you know, you know, in
attacking grand narratives kind of way.
Yeah, they attack grand narratives, but to also support stuff like standpoint epistemology and stuff like that, which Baudrillard would explicitly reject, because this whole tradition is actually kind of a rejection of Lukács. So, you know, his instrumentalized use by a kind of radical liberal academia would probably have disgusted him. even though he was alive when it really began.
Yeah.
So, you know, I also feel like, however, he's too dangerous for conservatives to latch onto. So when Derrida died, for example, there were all these paleocons who actually wrote pins to how awesome Derrida was, you know, Derrida's deconstruction plus Chomsky's critique of U.S. foreign policy inspired a lot of these paleo conservatives. You didn't see any of that for Baudrillard because, I mean, his black pill kills their attempts at meaningful nationalist narratives and stuff, too.
I mean, yeah. I mean, you can't have a community, you can't have.
Right.
I think about
the
like
social as response to the political loses meaning, like
the idea that there is a kind of like real hearty, meaningful work and like product that like you can get back to in the hard work that isn't being like mass produced elsewhere. Like he would just be like, no, it's still bullshit. Like it would have to be a conservative version of like Russian nihilism. Like you just the grand tradition of losing faith in everything that, like that we all hold dear. Like,
yeah, I mean, exactly. It's almost just like it kind of takes this sort of French post-Marxist, late Marxist milieu to its logical conclusion. It also actually takes reactionaryism, skepticism so far down its own rabbit hole that it destroys it. I sometimes joke that I can use Baudrillard and Adorno to like, you know, to deprogram reactionaries too, because like you can throw this at them and then they're all of a sudden they're doubting everything, like mm-hmm. including their own meta narrative. But other than that instrumentalized use, I find it fascinating and I find it interesting how much he speaks to a real frustration in the Western left. I also find it very interesting how there isn't a whole lot you can do with this. I think it is, you know, I don't know what Baudrillard leaves you. You can't even like come up with a counter simulation that would be meaningful.
Mm-hmm. One of the critiques of him is like, at some level, you don't know if he's just consigned himself to enjoying the sensation of being angry at things right. or just, I'm just going to sit back, write some texts and eat candy while the world burns, like, because that's what I can do. Like, and like, one of the critiques, I guess, is like people don't know if it almost just feels like he's just enjoying himself because that's what he has, like given what he lays out.
Yeah, I mean, it's I find that interesting and somewhat useful, but it's also, you know, I don't know what people can really do with it. So, mm-hmm. I mean, I say it's useful. It's useful as a thought exercise, but it's not to be extremely useful in practical grounds. But I do find it interesting how he rhymes with a lot of American figures of a similar time period. Like I've told people that like he's a lot more like Christopher Lash than you think. It's just Lash actually does posit some kind of working class traditionalism in the late 80s that you could go back to, and Baudrillard would be like, nah, like that's not real either. Like,
yeah,
you know, for Baudrillard there is no out. You know, there absolutely isn't. And I guess you're out is like the jouissance of being the old man yelling at crowds. Like, but it's interesting how he sees the attempt at meaning leading to that. And then to go back to the system of objects, like it really does begin there. But there he seems to still think you could impose like these meta narratives, even in their breaking down, could mean something. Whereas, you know, even 5-6 years later, he doesn't think that. But a lot of the critiques that would lead him to that point are in the system of objects. Like they are already there.
Well, we are reaching about an hour. I don't know if you have any closing remarks you want to leave people with. I know that you've said that the divine left is the forgotten Baudrillard text that is more insightful than most of his more popular ones. And you said that's through Minnesota Press?
No, this is from Semiotics.
Oh, Semiotics.
Which I guess is MIT. But this, you know, his more famous stuff is Michigan, because for a while, University of Michigan was publishing all the like French post-structuralist stuff from the late 90s to the early aughts. And then, you know, Verso's selection of Baudrillard is just odd. Like it seems sporadic and random. Mm-hmm. like yeah. I have one of the later ones in my hands right here. The silver printing of Fragments, which isn't even like its original title. Fragments is originally Cool Memories 3. Yeah, there's Cool Memories that. Like 1 through 6, which are basically Baudrillard's like aphorism notebooks. And then, you know, they have what else do they have? They have
I think Mirror of Production.
Passwords.
They've got Passwords.
In the Spirit of Terrorism, I think.
Yeah, that's one of those like later ones.
But it's just weirdly random. Like, well, and they don't have a lot of the key ones. Like a lot of the ones that are considered more academically important are not. They're not with Verso for some reason. But yeah, so you'll have fun with it. I think if you find this text infuriating, some of the later ones are going to drive you really up the wall.
That's all for this episode. Thank you for listening, and we're looking forward to starting season 2 very soon. If you want to support the podcast and you're already on our Patreon feed, please consider leaving us a positive review on iTunes or the podcatcher of your choice, and sharing any of your favorite episodes so far on social media. It's always useful to get more people involved and giving us feedback so that we know what's working, what's not, what people like hearing more about. It's always appreciated. Thank you for listening, and we hope you'll join us next time.